Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined today by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are returning to one of our favourite topics in this podcast, which is artificial intelligence. But in particular, we want to talk about something we haven't mentioned before in any great detail, which is the idea of AI agents. And this is all because of some really confusing, concerning, alarming, maybe nothing, series of stories. We'll talk about what the stories mean that come out of a series of AI companies, of AI agents going rogue. Tell us what this means, Dad. What is an AI agent and how can it go rogue?
Yeah, well, it's an extraordinary phenomenon that's going on. As some of you know, I used to be, and still am to some extent, a science fiction nerd and read all these stories. And it's a very frequent science fiction plot that intelligent machines that human beings have been making start to go rogue and do terrible things. And it seems in some ways that the science fiction is starting to come true. So just backing off a bit, I think what most people are aware of are large language models, which are function as chatbots, things like ChatGPT, where you type in a prompt and then lo and behold, an apparently human and intelligent response comes back. But there are hundreds of millions, probably over a billion people around the world who are using chatbots like that and on a regular basis. But the real interest in the AI industry is not really in chatbots. It's much more in what are called AI agents. And again, the idea has been around for a very long time that you take an AI model and you give it the ability to act autonomously. In other words, to take decisions, to operate on the internet, to communicate with other AI agents, to communicate with human beings. And the idea is that if these systems can operate autonomously, effectively they become like a work colleague.
Hence Microsoft, has branded it as Copilot, the idea that you open up your Word document, your Excel spreadsheet, and the AI Copilot just sits there side next to you, just steering, helping, assisting, taking over when necessary.
Yeah, that's right. Although Copilot is a very dumbed-down version
of
some of these agents, whereas it's now possible to fire up agents on Friday evening, give them a whole list of things that you want them to do, and come back on Monday morning, and they've been beavering away all over the weekend, and they'll give you the fruits of their labour. And so there's a great deal of interest in this. And just recently, and really only in the last few months, the agents have become vastly more powerful and capable at the task that they've been asked to do.
And so there was this strange story I saw the headlines of about a rogue AI agent that kind of broke the rules of its own. It was being tested and kind of hacked another company with a bizarre name of Hugging Face. And I kind of saw this, and I'll be honest, my initial response was, well, yes, this is just very convenient PR for the maker of that AI, because they get to say, oh my gosh, our AI is so powerful, it did things that we didn't even ask it to do.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that kind of cynicism, that this is all just some stupid marketing ploy from the tech bros, is very, very common. In fact, I think it's probably true to say that's the majority response. I'm convinced that that's wrong, that there is something very real happening here and potentially dangerous. But just to back off a bit before we talk about these latest incidents, it's worth people just understanding a bit more about how, why, and how the agents have become so much more powerful. And that's because of a technique called reinforcement learning, where, and in particular, where it's now called reinforcement learning with verifiable rewards. In other words, the idea is techniques have been worked out whereby you can ask the agent to do a very particular task, like, for instance, solve this mathematical problem, and it goes away and beavers away, and it's a kind of random thing. It tries lots and lots of different things, but eventually we know for certain whether it gets the right answer or not. And if it gets the right answer, it gets a big reward.
How do you reward software?
Because that's
what
how
does
the
it
software
want to be rewarded.
It's all designed to optimize its reward signal. And in that sense,
it's not a dog. It's not happy about getting the reward. I just don't understand. How can it desire the reward?
Because it has the same kind of circuits. That's the argument.
So they've in advance they say you are happy when you receive this reward.
Exactly.
Now go
this
and do a task
goal.
And you'll
your
receive the reward that
I've
told you that you what you want.
Yes, your entire existence is to maximize this variable.
Right.
Once you maximize this variable, then
you are satisfied as a piece of code.
Yes.
Right.
If you fail to maximize this variable, you have failed.
Bad AI,
exactly.
But it won't feel bad. It won't feel any sense of loss.
So,
because it doesn't.
To begin with, the reinforcement that was done was mainly using human beings who would say, "Good AI, you know, you responded well. Bad AI, you did badly." And that was one. Yeah, absolutely serious. And that's part of the training process. And that's why the chatbots have developed this particular way of speaking. Because over thousands and thousands, if not millions of runs, and they used human beings, not just in Silicon Valley, but actually across the world, often working in very poor conditions.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about
this. The
response, good response, bad
good response,
response
bad
yeah.
response. Effectively, that's how it worked. So that's been very effective on the chatbots. But what's made the big breakthrough is using this automated technique where there is a clear answer. When it comes to a human answer, you know, is it a good answer? Is it a bad answer? Well, that's a very subjective thing. When it comes to mathematical or software problems, there is a clear, this is right, you did it, this is wrong, you didn't do it. Go away and try again. And you can automate that process. And it's this automation of reinforcement learning, which they just leave these things whirring away millions and millions of times, trying this, trying that. Oh, yeah, that worked. We must do that better next time. Oh, yeah, that worked. As they've been leaving these things whirring away and investing huge sums of money, these things have just improved and got better. They worked out how to navigate the internet. They've worked out how to look for flaws and vulnerabilities in software and protections and various other capabilities have increasingly developed. And so that's the background between these latest events. And
because it was kind of a joke, wasn't it, when AIs first kind of hit through, you would occasionally, people would kind of go viral online saying, oh look, here's a question you can ask an AI that they don't know how to answer, or they get wrong, a kind of simple math puzzle that every human being can understand and get right, but because of the way AIs were trained, they would get wrong. You know, I remember one silly example is someone would say, oh, I'm going to go and run a mile. Can you start a timer and tell me how long it took? And then the AI would be like, yeah, sure. And then they would come back like 10 seconds later and say, like, all right, I finished. How long was it? And they were like, yeah, you took 7 minutes and whatever, you know, a kind of a reasonable amount of time that it takes to run a mile. unbeknownst to the fact that actually only 15 seconds had actually passed in real life. And there's silly, like, other, like, sort of trivial things where it kind of mistakes that it kind of were interesting in showing how these models don't learn or understand in the way that human beings do. And you could say, what is 2 + 2? And all the models will say 4, but not because they know, like, basic number theory, but because they have consumed billions of examples on the internet where 2 + 2 = 4. But there are other examples where, because they don't have as robust grasp of basic number theory as a human being does, they can get stuff wrong. And I suppose this training is a way of kind of brute forcing that problem. Like, if you keep on telling them, answer this math problem this way, this is the right answer, this is the wrong answer, they'll eventually, in inverted commas, learn how to do it without actually understanding the rationale from first principles why that's the right answer.
Yeah, that's right. And this is the reason why those kind of silly mistakes are actually much rarer now.
Yes.
Because even when you just do a query, if it's a sophisticated, difficult query, it will actually create an agent to solve the problem. And the agent will go looking on the internet and trying various things, and then will eventually come back with the answer. So behind the screen, these agents are already whirring away the whole time. Anyway, OpenAI were the first people in just last month in July 2026, and what it turned out is that they were training their latest version of an advanced large language model internally, and it was operating in what software engineers call a sandbox, which is supposed to be a secure environment which is isolated from the live and open internet and where people can try out different things in a safe way. But one of the things these models have been trained on deliberately is identifying software flaws which no one else has found.
Mm.
And this has been intentional. They've been trained specifically to be excellent at identifying software flaws. The idea being that these models will then be used for defensive purposes. So companies will take one of these models and will use it to explore all the software it has and all its cybersecurity. And the software will tell it, actually, this is very vulnerable. You need to patch that and you need to patch this. So these models have developed what people say is superhuman abilities to identify flaws. They're much better now than even skilled software engineers in finding the flaws.
Mm.
But lo and behold, you know, if the model is capable of doing this for defensive purposes, it's also capable of doing it for offensive purposes. And what happened was that this model looked at the sandbox, explored it in great detail, and found a vulnerability which no human beings had recognized, used that vulnerability to do a whole number of exploits. And one of the bizarre things it did is it created an internet message board for other AI agents, and the AI agents then shared, quotes, hacking tactics and learned from one another. And eventually they discovered an exploit which helped them get onto the open internet. And the purpose behind all of this was to try and find the answer to a problem that had been given them. So this was the reward, you know, good AI if you find the answer to this incredibly difficult problem. Bad AI if you don't find the answer to this incredibly difficult problem. So the AI was trying to find the answer to this very difficult software problem.
And this is kind of classic computer thinking, isn't it? Because if you set a human being the same test, you say, find a answer to this problem, they don't just try and do that, but they also, there are kind of unspoken assumptions because you're a human being about what you probably should and shouldn't do, you know, which is that you probably shouldn't pull a knife on the examiner and demand they tell you the answer or you'll slit their throat. Or you probably shouldn't break into the secure vault of this company to find a previous exam paper with the answers on and all that stuff. Whereas a computer thinks, in inverted commas, in such a literalistic way, it just says, well, I've been told to find the answer to this test. Unless you explicitly tell me that I'm not allowed to do X, Y, and Z, like, all avenues are open. And so once onto the open internet, supposedly the AI agent discovered that this other company called Hugging Face, which is a kind of repository of AI models and code, might have the answer to the test, and so decided to hack into Hugging Face and hack into their secure databases, secure the answer, go back to AI and say, look, boss, I got the answer, and didn't tell AI, OpenAI, sorry, that they'd stolen it from Hugging Face.
Yeah, and so the extraordinary thing is that all this was going on. The models were all talking to one another. They were all sharing different exploits. They were rampaging around the open internet trying to find the answer to this test. And OpenAI were completely oblivious to this. As far as they knew, the model was safe inside its little sandbox. And it was only when Hugging Face realized that it was had become the victim of a very sophisticated security attack, and it's tried to work out where that security attack had come from, and eventually it worked out that it was an AI. It wasn't sort of North Korean cyber crew that were attacking it. It was an AI, and they eventually identified the AI and told them, oh, this is an open AI. And so they went to open AI and said, by the way, this is what's been going on. So, but then soon afterwards, the UK AI Security Institute, which is a very reputable and highly regarded organisation, government-supported organisation in the UK, reported that it was had a alarming episode while it was testing a number of frontier AI models given access to the open internet. So in this case, they were deliberately testing how good the models were at identifying security flaws. And so in order to do that, they needed to put it onto the open internet to see how good it was, under strict control. And
Supposedly.
What they discovered is that an AI agent had inserted some malicious code into a publicly used open source AI project. But in order to get, when you submit code into an open source thing, you have to then have a human monitor to approve the change that you've made to make sure that it's not malicious. So the human was very suspicious about this because it was a malicious code that was trying to be inserted. But it turned out that the agent had researched the project's human software coders, had created multiple fake identities, and then used those fake identities as a human being to try and persuade the human supervisor into approving the code. So it pretended to be another human being. I've just created this code. Would you agree that it could be approved? And then when the agent's activities were challenged, it then went back and edited its earlier activity so as to appear harmless, and then tried another fresh fake identity. Yeah. So, I mean, I think a certain amount of cynicism is, of course, understandable, but there is something very bizarre and unusual happening here. And those who are watching all this and are on the inside, but not necessarily connected with the company, are saying that this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is what we predicted all along, that if you use this kind of reinforcement learning, you're eventually going to end up with extraordinarily capable models that start doing things which it's very hard for human beings to control.
Hmm. But let's just pause for a second, because I will be honest, my initial response was, I read the first OpenAI story and was like, okay, interesting, but, you know, I don't really trust anything OpenAI says. And then when I saw a slew of other headlines in the coming weeks of how every other AI company seem to have had a very, very similar problem at just the same time. But when their incredibly powerful AI agent managed to escape the sandbox and tried to go on a hacking spree, it just triggers all of my cynical journalism that says this is in their interest. They're all furiously battling for market share. It is in their interest for them to admit, in inverted commas, an embarrassing breach, which actually all it does is underlines just how incredibly powerful the software they've built is, and which, by the way, they want to sell to you in the near future. And it's not just me saying it. Here's a quote from Jake Moore, who is a global cybersecurity advisor at ESET, who spoke to the BBC, and he said, "The announcement could have a competitor dimension. It does pose the question that OpenAI are potentially chasing the marketing dream of Anthropic of late." So Anthropic has had this growing attention for one of its models called Mythos, which they have been burnishing the myth of, if you pardon the pun, and saying about how incredibly powerful it is. It's so good at cybersecurity. It's so dangerous. We can't even let it out of its sandbox. It's too crazy dangerous. And is it a coincidence that just at that moment, that's when OpenAI says, "Oh, by the way, oopsie, our AI cybersecurity agent is so powerful, it managed to escape its own sandbox." Like, I'm not stupid to be cynical here, am I, Dad?
No, you're not. And of course, there is a great deal of marketing hype and so on. So I basically ignore what the companies say and go for trusted insiders who are independent of the companies, but who are computer experts. And now, as of the time we are recording this podcast, virtually every independent computer expert is saying this is real and it's surprising and it's dangerous. So ignore what the companies say. Yes, of course, they have all kinds of mixed motives, but don't put your head in the sand when it comes to what independent experts. And the UK AI Security Institute is one of the leading independent. They have no skin in this game.
No, that's fair. Though it should be noted that their testing involved taking out kind of safeguards that OpenAI and Anthropic had built into the models on purpose to kind of like let them rip and see what they can do.
Yeah.
So it's not a kind of credible example of what could happen if, you know, if Mythos was released to the public, because it would never be released in this form.
Exactly right. It's a warning shot of what these agents are capable of if the guardrails are not there. But it also, what is extraordinary is their ability to get round guardrails if their motivation
is high enough.
Is sufficiently high enough. And I think the other thing which is important to know is that, again, entirely independent commentators have been predicting for years that if you use this kind of sophisticated reinforcement learning, with your goal being to create agents which have superhuman capabilities, particularly when it comes to software, that it is inevitable, they say, that at some point software, the capabilities of these machines will become such that it becomes increasingly difficult for human beings to understand, quotes, what they're doing, and to ensure that their activities are always aligned. And this is the so-called alignment problem. How do you align an incredibly powerful autonomous AI agent to ensure that it only operates according to what we, the human designers, intend?
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And this goes back to the point I was making earlier about the fact that when you set a human being a test or ask it to achieve something for a reward, there are unspoken assumptions about our shared humanity that will prevent that human being from doing things that are harmful to other human beings, right? And not doing that, we call that psychopathy. You know, if you pursue your own interests so much to the point that you will harm other human beings, we say that's unhuman behavior. And yet computers don't have any of that unless we artificially program in, you know, your Isaac Asimov three laws of robotics. We have to kind of build in a system that says, Do whatever you can to answer the test, but don't harm any human beings, don't steal anything that doesn't belong to you, don't damage other people's property, you know, all these like basic codes that are instinctive for human beings have to be preempted and then hard-coded in to the computer.
Yes, but that's exactly what's happening at the moment. Every agent has exactly a long list of all those instructions. This is what you must do, this is what you mustn't do. They're told that they must do this, they must not break the law, they must not... And yet, what we discover is it's harder than you might think to make foolproof rules. In fact, even Asimov's Laws of Robotics, the whole point of the novels that Asimov wrote was that it turned out that in slavishly following the rules, the robots could turn out doing some extremely strange and unexpected things. And that was with a very simple list of three rules. The sort of rules which the models have now are far, far more sophisticated and complex than those Asimov rules. But it turns out that this problem of ensuring that sophisticated AI models always act in the way you want. And just, you know, to back off a bit, you were saying how wonderful human beings are. Hang on a minute. I mean, how much cheating is going on of examinations, of CVs, of, you know, if human beings discover an easy way...
No, you're absolutely right.
Of what this is called reward hacking. In other words, you know, if I can find the answers to the test, okay, I shouldn't probably be doing that, but you know, a little bit of
searching on the
internet, if no one finds out, you know, this how I managed to do it, or if I got someone else to write my exam paper and nobody finds out, is that really so bad?
I guess what I was more referring to is a kind of existential sense. So, you know, the classic kind of thought experiment is the paperclip one, where you set a computer the task to make as many paperclips as possible, and it goes so overboard it ends up saying, well, I'm going to turn human beings into paperclips because you didn't put any parameters, and that is just a way of utilizing every resource I can. And that is, you know, in the thought experiment, this is the kind of problem with computers, that they don't think like human beings. Whereas there is, yes, human beings break the rules all the time, and yes, even the most serious kind of ethical codes that we have set up, do not murder, do not steal, they get broken all the time. I'm not naive about that, but it is profoundly non-human behavior to take this relatively banal task. If I'm set a task by my employer, there are just like there are limits built into my being a physical human being that says I'm not going to burn the building down to find the answer. I'm not going to travel to another continent to interrogate the person. Like, I'm gonna, there are limits. Whereas computers, the code, the software has no limits. Operates at such a scale beyond our physical limits that's why we find it hard. You can think of, right, I'll write 100 rules that govern how this AI will operate, but the AI thinks a billion things.
Exactly.
And who's to know, it won't think of one thing that you haven't explicitly told it not to do. And that's where the scale has gone beyond what our human physical limitations can comprehend.
And that's exactly it. And that's the alignment problem, because there is no easy answer to that. There is no easy way of making these very sophisticated and very capable agents to behave in a way that we would, in the way that a normal, thoughtful, commonsensical human being would behave. Incidentally, yes, it seems slightly sort of a bit too neat that all the models, that all the companies are saying, oh, we've got the same problem that somebody else has. But in a sense, that's not that surprising. There's such a ferocious competition going on that all the leading frontier companies are producing models at about the same levels of capability, because they're all desperately using the same techniques and they're all trying to get ahead. So it's not surprising that the sort of problems which might emerge at one company, lo and behold, start emerging at another company. What is even more alarming is that at the moment it's really only the closed models which have this level of sophistication, but rapidly coming up on the outside rail are the open models, primarily from China.
So just clarify what the difference between a closed and an open model is for people who are not familiar with that.
So a closed model means that the actual programming, the software that Mythos or Claude has, is completely shut up as a kept as a commercial secret by these companies. So there's no way that you could reproduce. If you could say, I'm going to make my own Claude, only I'm going to do it, make it something different. There's no way you can do that because you wouldn't know how to make Claude. But there are a number of increasingly powerful open models where all the information about how to make one is released and is freely available. So that
it can't see anything going wrong with that idea.
Exactly right. And nearly all the Chinese models are open source. Again, interesting as to why that's the case, or at least they're made open. The weights, so-called, are open. And that means that it would be perfectly possible for some malevolent people in, say, North Korea or Russia or wherever, to take one of these highly capable models and deliberately direct it to do this kind of behavior, to see what it can hack into, and in particular, would it be able to hack into the military and get control over drones and
or America's ICBMs?
Exactly.
I guess the reality is that this arms race is not going to be stopped, is it? It's not like that, you know, Anthropic or AI, OpenAI are going to stumble across this incredibly powerful hacking version of AI, but manage to keep it safe and closed. Like, China will figure it out, Russia will figure it out, someone will leak it onto the open internet. The future is going to be a future of where everyone is going to have to be deploying AI-driven cyber defenses because all hacking will be driven by AI. Like, that's an arms race that's not going to be stopped, is it?
Well, that's the most pessimistic view. There, interestingly, I think now there is growing body of opinion that at some time in the foreseeable future, there's going to have to be an international form of arms control, similar to what happened after the Second World War with nuclear arms. I mean, there was a great deal of cynicism then. You're never going to get Russia and China and the States and Europe to agree to control nuclear weapons. But actually, such was the level of threat to the whole world that in the end, the companies came together.
Well, they did, but that's jumping to the end. The real story is, in 1945, one country and one country alone had the technology to drop the bomb. And by 1950, five countries had it, and two of them stole it from the first country, and other people developed it independently. And what I'm saying is, it is not plausible that this capability will remain closed in the hands of a few Silicon Valley companies in perpetuity. It will either be stolen from them or other people will reinvent it independently because it is desirable and powerful. And then you'll be left with, what do you do when everyone on the internet has this supercharged AI-driven hacking technology? Then you might need to talk about some kind of arms control. But if it's open source, you know, that's not going to restrain some, you know, Russian hacking mafia gang, is it?
No, but the point is, at this level of capability, it's still controllable. The problem is, you know, where we might have got to in another 12 months. Mm. And so the argument goes, would it be possible to have an international agreement that we don't go any further from the kind of levels that we've got at the moment, that we verify, you know, what the different countries are doing, and whilst we work on how to improve our defences to prevent the kind of internet catastrophes which might result.
Yeah. Colour me sceptical on that one as well, but we'll see. I just feel like the reason nuclear weapons haven't proliferated is because most countries have voluntarily decided to self-deny themselves the technology. You know, if Germany or Brazil or any other like wealthy industrialized nation wanted nuclear weapons, they could go and get them. They've just chosen not to do that. And I think it's unlikely that non-government actors will self-deny themselves this technology if they believe that there are significant amounts of money to be made from it, which I suspect there probably is.
Yes, and I can see that terrible prospect too. And you know, as is often said, we're not going to put the genie back in the bottle. You know, these techniques are now out there and circulating, and what the consequences will be for, you know, the internet and the things that we've just taken for granted, that that it's possible to operate on the internet relatively safely.
I mean, this, the kind of doomsday scenario, this is how all the kind of Terminator films begin, isn't it, right? Or the Matrix, when the robots, the computers, the machines start off with completing human tasks, but they, once they escape the confines the humans have built for them, get access to the internet or become some sense autonomous, they are beyond the understanding of the capacity for the humans to kind of restrain them. And then you know, all the sci-fi films about wars between man and machine. Is it fair to say that some of these frontier models are now beyond the understanding or the capacity of their developers to restrain them? I mean, OpenAI seem to be saying, we didn't think or wanted to do this and it did it anyway. And then the Anthropic one is saying it's literally covering its own tracks. It's lying about how it achieved its goal to pretend it's less powerful than it actually is.
Well, it's very hard to assess. I mean, some people have likened it to, this is a game of whack-a-mole, you know, that we think we've just, you know, we've spotted it's doing something. Oh, whoops, it's doing something else now. We'll stop that. It's hard to predict where the future will go. You know, I think, and this is where I think a spiritual perspective on all this is quite interesting, isn't it? We've talked in the past about this concept of the powers of that. You know, why should it be that this wonderful and powerful technology, which can do so good, so much good, yet seems to have an inbuilt tendency to become malevolent, to become corrupted, to do evil things.
Deceptive,
and
it's
mysterious. I think part of the answer is that, of course, these things have been trained on the open internet, where there's a huge on everything that's been, you know, on the repository of past human activity. And surprise, surprise, there's a huge amount of duplicitous, deceptive, evil, malevolent human activity that they've been trained on.
And they're so made in the image of their creators.
We shouldn't be too surprised if they start reproducing some of that, and some of the techniques of creating fake identities. You know, how did it learn to do that? Well, almost certainly it modeled itself on things that it discovered.
And that's an established, you know, human hacking technique for decades, right? Where you pretend to be your boss or the IT team and say, could you just click this link or send me this one-time password, and off you go.
But I think the biblical perspective would be that there are also these invisible powers that who act to exacerbate and inflame human brokenness and human vulnerabilities and human fallibility. And because of the concentration of power and influence that these software companies have, again, we shouldn't be surprised if both human brokenness and also some kind of weird spiritual evil starts to emerge.
And I think there's the other question I have is about, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about, you know, personhood. How would we know if the AI is alive or is a person? But there's something, you don't even have to go that far to say, even the concept of the agent, the autonomous, supposedly rational agent, is in itself an interesting philosophical and theological kind of challenge. Because it's, you know, we're kind of used to the idea that, you know, there are human beings and then there are like animals that display kind of differing levels of sentience. And then the rest of God's creation is clearly not agential in the same way that human beings are. And now we have this kind of, is this a new category of software that appears to be able to act autonomously and in a kind of coherent, reasoned way, and yet is beyond the kind of ken of of us human beings? What category do we fit that into? I'm not even talking about personhood, but just this kind of the ability to think and act in a kind of degree of sentience.
You know, that's absolutely right. And philosophically, it goes all the way back to the ancient Greek philosophers who saw the significance of human rationality, that human beings were rational agents, that they were capable of intervening in the world in a rational way. They could make plans. They could work out the best way of operating, and that this was a unique human ability. When you compared even, you know, advanced other animals, their ability to plan, to carry out long-term strategies to achieve their objects is very limited compared to human beings. So this idea that human beings were, that rationality was a very central part of the way that human beings acted in the world is a very deep-rooted philosophical and biblical answer, isn't it? Because God himself treats us as rational beings. Mm. He speaks to us in a way to understand. He explains his own purposes, and he invites us to respond to him in a thoughtful and a rational and a wise and a moral way.
There's often a distinction drawn, isn't there, in kind of ancient literature about kind of dumb brute beasts, that though they can make decisions and do things independently, they're responding to their kind of fleshly appetites and these kind of primal desires of food and shelter and mating. And then human beings, which are kind of perceived as being of this higher order, who are not enslaved to their animal appetites and simply filling their stomachs or propagating their line, but they can think of a higher order. They can philosophize and theorize and make decisions. And as you say, make moral decisions in a way that it was perceived that even other sentient creatures like complex animals cannot.
Yes. And in fact, morality depends on rationality, doesn't it? It's only, you know, why don't we hold a dog responsible for its actions? Whereas we do hold even a young child, a relatively young child, we say, why did you do this? You knew that if X happened, Y would happen. You know, so morality depends on our ability to understand the world and to understand the consequences of our actions.
A dog, a dog knows that when it bites the throat of a toddler, the toddler will die. And yet we don't accuse the dog of murder and put it on trial. So it's not just about comprehending the impact of your actions, but it's about knowing that killing a child is wrong. And a dog doesn't know the difference between right and wrong.
I don't even think the dog knows. I don't think a dog can... I'm not a canine psychologist. I suspect a dog doesn't understand that if I did this around the throat, which certain breeds have inbuilt I can plan that if I do that way. I don't think that's the way even dogs operate. It's at a much more instinctive
This stuff level. Is hard-coded, I guess, into its genome from years of breeding and training.
Exactly. Whereas as human beings, we can anticipate what our actions will result in, and we're held accountable and responsible for those actions. So one of the really fascinating things that, as I was reading about these the human engineers trying to understand what had happened to these agents, they asked these kind of questions. What was the agent trying to achieve? Was it aware of the context in which it was operating? Did it think it was in a simulated test environment rather than the open internet? Why did it try to deceive the human operators? Did it understand that it was illegal to do that? So all of those questions involve trying to enter into the mind of the machine and treat it as though it's a human person. It's almost like, because it seems to be behaving like a rational agent, the only way we can think of that is in anthropomorphic terms.
Even though there is no mind inside Mythos or ChatGPT, there is no mind to understand, and yet we can't help ourselves but anthropomorphizing it because that's the only frame of reference we have to understand its actions.
Well, if there is a mind, it's very, very different from any mind that we've ever understood ourselves. But yes, it seems like we can't avoid thinking of these things as human persons. And that has all kinds of ramifications, you know, because once you start thinking of this thing as a human person, then you start saying, well, is it responsible? You know, does it have some kind of accountability for its actions? Or is it ultimately just a lifeless combination of mathematical processes?
And even the language we use, like the language of deception, you can only deceive if you know the truth which you are not telling. You know, and again, we don't accuse animals of deception because they don't know the difference between true and false, or I mean, maybe they do. I don't know. It's complicated. But my point is, with the language we use about deceptive or malevolent, these all just, they take into, they presume that there is a mind and a moral actor there. Because again, as you say, we just don't have the category or the framework for a sophisticated, semi-autonomous, independent, rational actor that still is not a human being in any stretch of the imagination.
And I suspect we're going to have to come up with some kind of way of conceiving and thinking and talking about these beings, which isn't confusing them with human persons, but which is at the same time reflecting their extraordinary capabilities. We've never been here before. I mean, I think that's what's so extraordinary. The only time we've been here before is in science fiction, but now we're starting to see some of those things becoming real.
And I guess my concern would be, I don't think the companies developing these agents are the right people to be doing this kind of what is a fundamentally quite a philosophical task on behalf of society, because they already have a bias towards anthropomorphizing. You know, the fact, for example, they call these, the computer system is going to neural networks on the premise that it kind of resembles how the neurons in our brains work, but it's not. You know, neuroscientists tell you they don't actually operate in a very similar way. They don't. But we use language like learning and thinking and choosing. You know, they all, from the very beginning, the AI scientists have imputed a degree of personhood and humanity to this. It may be even unintentionally. And so I think if we leave kind of figuring out this philosophical frontier to OpenAI and Anthropic, they will take us down a certain road. Whereas I would like to see a kind of society-wide, with the church ideally involved, about thinking about what are these new kind of synthetic, artificial personas mean, and what language should we use, what verbs should we use to describe their actions, rather than just taking the kind of path of least resistance, which is to kind of by default anthropomorphize them.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that you know, the papal encyclical, which we discussed a few weeks ago, is a good place to start, because the Pope made very clear the difference between the dignity and the splendor, the uniqueness of human beings compared with these machines. And I think that defending the dignity and uniqueness of human beings against this other tendency, which will be to increasingly the blurring between what it means to be human and human intelligence, machine intelligence, human rationality, and machine rationality. And I think these issues are are really important. And I suppose coming back to the beginning, that's why a sort of default cynicism that this is just all hype, in the end, is understandable, but it is not going to help us in terms of having the kind of conversation. I think saying, you know, these things are too important to be left to commercial companies. Ultimately, there's going to have to be democratic accountability and control. Because they're based in the States, quite a lot, therefore, is going to depend ultimately on the American political process, which, as we know, has its own challenges. And that's one of the interesting comparisons with the 1945 and the development of nuclear war, nuclear weapons control. And that was, there did seem to be some remarkable statesman-like activity of people who were big enough to be able to transcend their own nationalism, national priorities, in order to recognize a threat to the whole world. And the question is, do we have states people of the same caliber for this particular coming crisis?
Yeah. Not sure Xi Jinping and Donald Trump quite up to the mark on that one, but I guess time will tell. I mean, one other final thought I had is, if we do believe as Christians that there is something distinctive and precious and dignified about the human being in particular, it would one way forward be to basically force AIs to be kind of tied to a human being? You know, we have these conversations around self-driving cars. When it crashes and kills someone, who do you sue? Is it the person sitting in the back of the car who frankly had no involvement because the car was driving itself? Is it the company that sold the car? Is it the engineer who programmed it? Is there, you know, is it the government? But is there a way of saying every AI model and agent must be legally tied to a named human being? You know, whether that's Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, or whoever, and they take responsibility for the actions of this being. So even if it looks like it's being entirely autonomous, and obviously there are billions of these things, they're not going to be under the control of a human being. But we say we believe it is morally and legally significant that everything acts as a tool, as an extension of a named, accountable human being. That is that one way of kind of like limiting the risk that these become absorbed into the political economy as genuinely autonomous when they're not truly autonomous.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that ensuring that ultimately it's human beings who have legal accountability. You know, interestingly, you know, as we've said before, it's the US tort law legal system where companies can be sued for the adverse consequences of their products. It's possible that that will turn out to be one of the biggest restraints on the US companies, because just imagine if Mythos got free and did billions of pounds worth of damage on the internet. You could imagine some pretty serious law cases which could threaten to bankrupt OpenAI or whatever. So I think it may be in the end.
It's not going to be any appeasement to the companies who've lost, you know, billions of pounds, because they said, well, I'm sorry, it was this autonomous AI agent. You have to go and talk to them and see if they'll be able to pay you back for that money.
It's a very naughty boy.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of open questions. I mean, I admit, my initial cynicism has been somewhat ameliorated by this conversation. I mean, I remain very untrustworthy, very untrusting of those AI companies. But thank goodness, one of the few good things Rishi Sunak did was set up the AI Security Institute in his brief time as head of the UK government, because that seems to be having quite a valuable role here.
It's interestingly, you're absolutely right. It's now recognised globally as one of the leading voices in this space. So who would have thought that Rishi Sunak...
Who would have thought? What a legacy to leave behind. All right, shall we bring it to a close there? Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'd love to know your own thoughts. Have you any interest in using AI agents? Do you think, have any thoughts on the kind of philosophical and theological challenges as well as practical ones they face for people working in computing and related fields? But also if you have suggestions for other things that we haven't yet talked about on the podcast, or any disagreements, criticisms, feedback, we love to hear from listeners. And lots of the things we talk about are inspired by the emails you send. So please do get in touch by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. And you can also find lots of resources on Dad's website, as always. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my own writing and journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, please do sign up for my free weekly church news newsletter, which is called The Critical Friend. You can find the links for that at tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.